We'll start with this one because otherwise our education specialist, Emmy Steele, Miss Emily Steele, they call her Miss Emmy. Miss Emily actually does a program called Kids on Mission. Like if you've ever, like your kids kind of think dinosaurs are cool, they're kind of interested in this stuff, but you're like, I don't know what to do with it after that. I'm not sure. I'm like, I'm excited that they're excited, but I don't know what to do with that. Well, especially if they're homeschooled or if, you know, they just, especially if they're home for summer and stuff like that. Kids on Mission is an online program where Miss Emily goes through and has multiple courses. They're 6-week courses. You sign up online. They get a package in the mail that they love. Sometimes the kids video their projects and getting stuff. They are so amazingly cute. It's horrible. We just sit there and just love it. So they actually get a package in the mail. They get their own little notebook, ICR notebook, and magnifying glass and pen. They get patches. Anytime they come to one of our events, one of our larger events, they get a patch for that. If they finish one of the courses and pass, they get a patch for that. And so it gives them the ability to actually continue to be excited and continue to learn. And so it's an online course. So it's not like something you're driving them somewhere. They can do it right there at home. You can help them. You can have fun actually doing this stuff with the kids. It is a lot of fun. So it's Kids on Mission. And they made these things so small. I don't even know. Can you print this small? I don't understand, but it is. It's Kids on Mission, and I have one of these patches. They're really cool. So if you have a kid who you think, we're talking like elementary school age, you know. There's actually like through third grade, first through third, and then fourth through sixth. And so she does 2 courses for each one. There's already Foundations of Science. It talks about the founders of science. There's also astronomy. There's a 6-week course on astronomy. She's working on biology and dinosaurs. She's a slacker. She hasn't done dinosaurs yet, but I'm trying to forgive her for that. But she'll eventually do dinosaurs. But right now there's 4 courses available, and it becomes like a session. Like the session opens, and then you just take the next one, and it is a lot of fun. It is so much fun. They get to do projects and experiments and all kinds of stuff. Sometimes the parents have more fun than the kids, I think. So be sure and check that out. Those are out on the table where the other stuff is, right there outside that door. You can pick one of these up. There's a QR code. You can go online, check out more, and you can sign up right there. And, of course, the kids love getting this package in the mail. They're so excited. So had to tell you about Kids on Mission. All right. Okay, there we go. So what are we going to talk about now? We're going to talk about the foundation. So in 2019, I actually did a conference in Austin, and it was called The Tower and the Flood. Why the Tower and the Flood? Because I think that the Tower of Babel and the global flood are the 2 keys to understanding the world around us. The flood helps us to understand the geological formations that we see, the fossils that we see, the water, everything. And then the Tower of Babel helps us to understand the people groups that we see, a.k.a. there are no races, okay? It's the people groups that we see. Where do the languages come from? You know, what about the difference in the cultures and things like that? We're going to talk about the Tower of Babel next. This time we're going to talk about the global flood. So the global flood is an interesting one. This is my longest talk. We're going to try and blast through it, okay? We can do it. All right, the global flood. This explains everything in the world around us. It shows us the fossils and the rock layers and everything. So I went to the Grand Canyon, and as you can see there, you can see all those layers in Grand Canyon. I mean, it's just a big hole in the ground. How many of you have been to the Grand Canyon? Okay, quite a few of you. Excellent. So, and you didn't fall in. That's good. That's good. So I've gotten to go there a couple times. This is a picture from the South Rim. And you just see all those layers. Well, here's the interesting thing. If we talk about the global flood, we're saying that everything was laid down by water. Well, that's not what conventional scientists want to say. But in the Grand Canyon, what they say is, well, almost all of it is laid down by water except for one layer. Now, they have to say that because there's marine fossils and animals in the other layers. So they have to say that, okay? But the Coconino sandstones is this, that kind of tan, that tan layer right there, the Coconino sandstones, they say, ah, that one was laid down by wind. The problem is that we actually have evidence to show that it was laid down by water, and we'll get into that here in a little bit. The talk this morning is called The Rocks Cry Out of a Global Flood. Now, when I talk, some people realize that I go a little long sometimes, but it's because I don't like talks that are like two myths about this or three facts about that. I want to help you understand a full argument or a full understanding of what we're talking about, especially when I teach youth. I want them to walk out that door and be able to tell their friends why dinosaurs aren't 66 million years old. Okay, that's what my goal in teaching is, for you to be. Can I say it? I pulled a Biden. Anyway, who knew that would be get the best reaction of the whole day, right? Oh my goodness. So now I forgot what I was talking about. So anyway, the global flood's really important. I want them to be able to articulate to their friends the reasons why they have this faith, right? The Bible says, hey, you ought to be able to say, tell people, be able to argue or be able to give a defense of your faith. And that's what I want to do every single time I talk, every single time I teach. So a lot of times what you'll see me do is I'll go at things from different perspectives. So for the flood, we're going to talk about the flood in the Bible, the flood in history. Do we see the flood in history? What do we find in the ground about the flood? What evidence is there of the flood? And then the flood in geological time. Don't we date rocks and disprove this whole flood thing? So there's a few things we're going to do. We're going to start out with the flood in the Bible. What does the Bible say about the flood? First of all, I want to make sure we're talking about the same flood, because when I was little, this is the flood that I was taught, right? All animals are stuck in the little ark. Everybody's smiling and happy. There's rainbows. It's like, is that what the Bible says about the flood? No, that's not what it says. But I was taught that when I was little. This is me when I was little. I know, I was cute. And no, I don't know what happened, and I don't want to talk about it. Okay, now, so this is what I was taught in Graham, Texas, First Baptist Church in Graham, Texas. Okay, this is what I was taught. And we were amazing Christians. My sister and I, my grandfather cleaned the church. My sister and I would go with him, and we would have races to see who could crawl under the pews to the front fastest. And so that was my growing up. So, but that's the Noah's flood that I learned. But let's go to the Word of God to find out what God says about water, because evolutionists are trying to figure out how all the water got on Earth. They think little droplets came in on meteorites and pieces of rock, and then each little droplet, poof, you know, just sat there until more droplets, poof, sat there until we get these oceans, okay? That's why they have to have millions of years. Because if they said that happened within 6,000 years, you'd look at them like they were idiots, okay? And rightly so. There's no way that happens in 6,000 years. I'm not saying that evolutionists are idiots. I'm just saying if they said that, you would look at them that way, okay? So what does the Bible say about water? Well, the first thing it says about water is right in the first couple of verses. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Wait a second. The water was there from the very beginning. When God created, he created the waters there. The waters never left. It's always been there. It's just moved around. You realize we have huge subterranean lakes and rivers that are running underneath the ground. There's actual caves in Arkansas. They have two huge lakes. One of them, they've never figured out the depth of it. It's that deep. Okay? There is water everywhere. Okay? And it's been moved around. That's all it is. So if we go from there and we go into one of the day, what day? Does anybody know what day this is? It says, let the waters in the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so, and God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. You may know what day it is? Did somebody say three? Yeah, three. Two is the firmament. Is the firmament. So here's the thing. As we continue on, we have to remember Genesis 7:11 is the next time he talks about water, significantly. And that's the flood. It's the beginning of the flood. Okay? So Genesis 7:11 says this, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened." Two things about that. Why is there a date there? Number one, it's a historical account, right? So everybody likes to say the Genesis, what, story? It's not an accurate way of saying it, is it? It's a historical account. It's giving you dates and names and what's happening. It's a historical account. The other thing is, it gives you a date at the end when Noah walked off the ark. And so you know exactly how long the flood was. Okay? Second thing is, it says the fountains of the great deep burst forth. That same original language, burst forth, is the same language it says Moses parted the Red Sea. In other words, something was coming apart, it was being ripped open, coming apart, coming undone. Okay? This is where we would say the plate tectonics begin. The plates are starting to separate, but they're moving rapidly. And what's going to happen if plate tectonics move rapidly? Really bad stuff, right? We get a little slip out in the ocean somewhere and an island disappears, right? Japan gets destroyed, things like that. So that's that same language. If we continue on, when I did a talk for was the Gideons, I had 200 children from the Gideons. I asked them, "Hey, how long is the flood?" They said 40 days and 40 nights. I said, "Raise your hand if it's 40 days, 40 nights." Every single one of them, except for one, raised their hand. Now here, I'm sure that's not what you're teaching, but we need to make sure that we're teaching our kids and make sure we know that the global flood was way longer than 40 days and 40 nights. If you read here in Genesis 7, 12, 17, and 20, it says, "And rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered." In other words, 40 days and 40 nights was just to get the ark up off the ground. That's all. 40 days and 40 nights of rain just to get the ark to float. Okay? We have to keep reading to see what else. If we take a look, I believe this is in Genesis, 7, 23 and 24. It says, "So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both men and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So that word prevailed, in other words, it's an active verb. It's actually raising or rising up. So the water is prevailing on the earth. So the water keeps rising for 150 days. And at that 150 day mark, that's when all the high mountains were covered by 15 cubits. So that's 150 days. We're still not done, though, for heaven's sakes. Okay, the global flood was a year-long catastrophic event that changed the face of the earth forever. That's what I want you guys to remember. It says in Genesis 8, says, "And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you." You've heard this one before. "Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. So God gave us dates to understand this. The first one was the 600th year, second month, 17th day. When he walks off the ark, it's the 601st year, second month, 27th day, which means the global flood was just over 1 year. That's a long time. That's not 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, there's some ministries that have created videos where this whole global flood thing just happens, like massive tsunami, and everything gets covered all at once, right? That's not what happened. We've actually studied this. There were 6 mega sequences to the flood. The scariest thing about the global flood is that there were 6 mega sequences. So one mega sequence would happen, tsunamis would come in, bury things. Animals and humans were getting up higher, okay? A second tsunami comes in, buries more things. Humans were not just covered in water. They watched their death come to them. They watched the punishment come to them. That's a scary thought. That's a sobering thought when we talk about the global flood. The global flood was not just 40 days and 40 nights of rain. Let's do a little housekeeping. Was it really a global flood, right? Or was it a local flood? Well, you can go to Austin at UT. They have a natural science museum, and they have this display here. There's, you know, skeletons of swimming reptiles and things, and it says this. But beginning about 545 million years ago, a shallow sea covered central and west Texas. Much of Texas remained underwater for the next 400 million years. Okay? I can go to any state and find the same thing. Why? Because everything was covered in water. But the museum's not going to say it was a global flood. So what they do is they say, well, Texas was covered in water. Well, we don't know about these other places, you know, but Texas was covered in water. But if you connect the dots, it's a global flood. It happens in every single museum. And so was it a global flood? Yes, it was a global flood. It was not a local flood. Think of it this way. If it was a local flood, then why didn't God just tell Noah to move? It took him over 100 years to build the ark. Do you realize that? Over 100 years. I'm pretty slow. I don't move fast. I've had 2 knee surgeries, okay? I think in 100 years I could get out of town, okay? I'm pretty sure I could do that. So why didn't you just tell Noah to move? Why did Noah have to take birds on the ark? If birds fly much faster than we walk, all they had to do was fly over to the area over here, land on a branch, and watch the chaos happen. But they had to be on the ark because there was no place for them to rest. Why did God use words like all, whole, and everything about it? We already read this, but let's just pay attention to these words. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high heavens under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upwards, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man. All in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things. Are you catching on that maybe it was everything? Like old earthers who say, old earthers have to have this be a local flood. Because if it's a global flood, it means it's a young earth. So old earthers have to have this be a local flood. Which means they have to do mental gymnastics to get around all, whole, covered, all, whole, every. They do some mental gymnastics to get around this stuff, but it's very plain that it was a global flood. What would be happening during a year-long flood? Remember I said this is where the plate tectonics start. And so here's an interesting fun fact, okay? I know a couple of fun facts. One's about oil we'll talk about later. Oh, actually we won't. I should tell you now. So fun fact about oil. We say, oil takes millions of years to form. All this oil is millions of years old. There's a problem. There's bacteria that eat oil. They feast on oil. If it's millions of years old, there would be no oil. Evolution has it completely wrong, okay? Oil is actually young, and the Earth is actually still producing some oil even today. There's a place, well, I'm usually in Texas, so I say over in California, Mexico. Over here in the ocean, there's a place that's actually still producing oil. It's a place that evolutionists found back in the 70s, and they were like, yeah, we're not really sure why, but there's still oil being produced over here, and it must be in like thousands of years. They're guessing, right? It must be like in thousands of years instead of millions of years. So we've known for a long time that oil doesn't take millions of years to be produced. And if it did, it wouldn't exist because there's bacteria that eat it all. That's a fun fact on oil. Fun fact on plate tectonics, as things start to rip apart, okay, it opens up. The plates open up like this, and it's pushed up and out, right? Number one, that's going to push water up, but also it's pushing out. Well, that means that something, if it hits, something has to happen. We actually see that there's subduction happening. So this plate actually subducts under this plate. This has been happening. So we actually believe we can show, based off the byproducts of new seafloor, that there was runaway subduction, and it didn't end until the new seafloor got to the other side and it stopped. But here's the interesting thing. You have this massive slab of plate that's underneath this one. If it takes millions of years for this to happen, this would be the same temperature as everything else around it. It would have millions of years to heat up and melt and be the same temperature. But if it's only a few thousand years old, it wouldn't. It would be a different temperature than everything else around it. Take a wild guess what we find when we look at the temperature of the slab. It's colder than everything else around it. That's a fun fact about plate tectonics. So what would be happening during a year-long flood? Well, we would have all kinds of things. We would have massive earthquakes. You would have huge earthquakes and multiple earthquakes as those plates move and are actually subducting and moving around. It would be the scariest thing you've ever seen. You would have tsunamis, but large tsunamis that would make this one. This is CCTV footage of the one in Japan. It happens fast, and it's scary. So look at that. It looks normal, and then all of a sudden, chaos just breaks out. And this would look like a kiddie pool compared to the tsunamis we'd be facing during the flood. And then there's volcanism. So as things move, the liquid rock is going to come up. Now, it's going to spew up into the air on the land. It's going to spew up ash. And a lot of what comes out in volcanoes is water in the form of steam. That's actually a lot of what comes out. So you would have ash and water coming out through the volcanoes. We actually have volcanism happening in the water as well, under the oceans as well. So all these things would be happening. It would be the scariest thing you've ever lived through. But you wouldn't live through it, right? So that's a good thing you didn't do it. But that's why I say, from now on, if you remember anything else about the global flood talk, okay, I want you to remember, well, the tidbit about the oil and the slab. But this one is more important. The global flood wasn't 40 days and 40 nights. It was a year-long catastrophic event that changed the face of the earth forever. Year-long catastrophic event that changed the face of the earth forever. Okay? So we find the flood in the Bible, and it is a very different story than what we find in Sunday school. But what about in history? Do we learn about the flood in history? We do. As a matter of fact, there's multiple flood accounts. And so like the Dead Sea Scrolls there, that's in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And then there's the Gilgamesh Flood Tablet. This is one of the most famous alternative flood stories that we have. It's currently in the British Museum. And so people say, well, because there's more than one, they must not be true. That doesn't even make sense. Okay, as a matter of fact, we find the flood account in over 300 different cultures around the world. In other words, everybody is talking about some kind of flood. Now, sometimes the details are going to be different, but everybody's talking about a flood. If everybody's talking about dragons, okay, when we talk about dinosaurs, sorry, Dino Dave, okay, if everybody's talking about dinosaurs, well, back in the day, they didn't have the word dinosaur. They were talking about dragons. If everybody talks about dragons in every culture around the world, do you think there was some kind of big, scary beasts that were walking around? Yeah, everybody's talking about them, okay? And we'll talk about how, yeah, there was winged serpents too, okay? I'm getting excited. I'll calm down. Now, so everybody talks about this. And, of course, evolutionists think, because the stories aren't exact, that means they're false. Or, you know, maybe the Bible just made it up or copied somebody else. Here's an article that says, yet tales of the flood spring from many sources. Myriad ancient cultures have their own legends of watery cataclysm and salvation. First of all, let's think of this. Just because you write it down first doesn't mean that it was first. Okay? Right? So originally, everything was passed on through verbal. Right? Cultures had not shamans, but they were like these elders that were in charge of just keeping the history of their people and being able to tell these histories. And what this guy wants you to believe is that the revered elder was sitting around, heard that this other tribe had a cool flood story, and goes, "Man, if only I had a flood story, then I'd be really cool." Isn't that offensive? It doesn't even make sense. Like, if everybody's talking about it, then it happened. So again, the question is, why the differences? Well, is anybody here in law enforcement? So a couple of you looked like you were scared. I was like, oh, I don't know. Okay. So you're in a safe place. Don't worry. Okay? So the thing is, if you're in law enforcement and you're trying to talk to two different suspects, you find two guys, you haul them in, you put them in different rooms, most police will tell you if the stories are exactly the same, they're starting to think it's a little suspect, because nobody remembers everything exactly the same, or it would be extremely rare, we'll say. Usually, when they hear a story and it's exactly the same, it's because they sat there and said, okay, here's what we're going to say, okay? Usually, when they hear a story that's pretty much the same but just a few different details, they go, okay, they're either telling the truth or they're weaving in the truth and a lie somewhere. The same would be true with the flood story. Think about it this way. Let's ask the question, why wouldn't their stories be the same? Well, the first one is, none of these people lived through it, right? So there was only 8 people that lived through the flood, and it ain't none of them, okay? So they're hearing the stories. Now, it's very possible at the Tower of Babel, Noah was still alive. Based off the genealogies, it's very possible Noah was still alive at the Tower of Babel, telling them, hey, guys, you're starting to worship other gods. The God of the Bible already punished us for being doughheads, okay? You need to come back to the God of the Bible. But they weren't listening to him. They were worshiping other gods. So none of these people lived through it. They're telling the story that crazy Uncle Noah told them, okay? And then, of course, the second thing is that, again, I just kind of said it, they worship different gods. So a lot of these nations, you have the Table of Nations within the Tower of Babel. Oh, I almost said the number, but that's key for my other talk. I can't say that. Okay. So a lot of these nations were worshiping different gods. So if you get isolated out, boom, Tower of Babel happens. Now you're over here in another land speaking a different language, and you worship the fish god. Are you going to tell the history of your people that the God of the Bible flooded the earth, or are you going to tell the history of your people that the fish god flooded the earth? You're going to say that the fish god flooded the earth. Otherwise, he's going to be ticked off that you're talking about the God of the Bible. You're cheating on him, right? So you've got to say the fish god flooded the earth, okay? And then think about this. Like, the name of Noah is different sometimes, like Noack or Nook or something like that. Like, that's simple stuff, okay? There's actual reasons why these stories would be different. Simple details that are changed. They're worshiping a different god. There's no way you're going to say the God of the Bible did this, okay? And then lastly, they all spoke different languages. You think about it. If you heard somebody tell the story of the global flood, and you're like, no, that's wrong. Susie, you said it wrong. Is anybody here named Susie? Okay, good. I was a little worried. No, Susie, you said it wrong. Okay, that's not how it happened. But if now they're off isolated out and they all speak different languages, now suddenly they can't tell anybody that they said it wrong. And so now whatever god they choose, whatever names they say, all that stuff is what they're telling their children and their children's children. Okay? So that's why you would have different stories. But do we have over 300 accounts of the global flood that line up besides a few details? Absolutely, yes, we do. The flood is recorded in history, either through verbal or for written. I became Biden there for a second. I'm sorry, I apologize. So the flood in the ground. Let's talk about the flood in the ground. This is where we're going to spend a lot of our time. We're going to try and blast through this. So what evidence are we finding for the flood in the ground? The evidence is massive, and we're going to go all the way down, okay? So the first one is the geological column. The geological column is excellent evidence of a young Earth and of a global flood, and here's why. When you look at the geological column, all these things are in order of how the animals are buried, okay? This is an actual order. This isn't something like evolutionists made up. This is an actual order. That's not in question. Okay, so this is a whole bunch of little things like sponges and plants and stuff, and then these little things that scurry along the bottom of the ocean. Then you have like things that that swim, and then things like amphibians and reptiles, then dinosaurs, and then lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! Okay, so here's the deal. There's the order there. The question is, what created that order? Well, there's two different worldviews. There's Darwinian evolution, and there's biblical creation. Darwinian evolution says it's when they lived. So all these things down here are uncomplex. They're simple. They're not designed for anything. And as you go up, it becomes more recent. And as you go up, it becomes more complex. And based off evolutionary thought, you know, you can kind of see that, okay? But there's a better explanation, and that is with biblical creation. When you have a tsunami come across the ocean, what's the first thing that's going to be buried? Because it's going to suck in all the sediment, dirt, mud, silt, sand, limestone, everything. As it comes across, what's the first thing it's going to bury? It's going to bury everything that's on the bottom of the ocean that can't get away, the sponges, the plants, things like that. The next thing it's going to bury is anything that's scurrying along the bottom or that's swimming in the ocean. It's going to bury that next as it comes across. And then as it comes across, it's going to get up on land, right? As it comes across and gets up on land, it's going to start hitting amphibians and reptiles and things that are in lowland areas. So amphibians and reptiles, and then it shows dinosaurs in that geological column. Well, actually, there's a swath right here that is actually a lowland area where we find most of the dinosaurs. We find the mass amount of dinosaurs in this lowland area. So as we talk about dinosaurs, we'll talk about how dinosaurs and man lived at the same time. Not necessarily in the same place, but they lived at the same time. That's an important distinction. So the water keeps coming across, it gets the dinosaurs, and then all the things that could get up higher, the lions and tigers and bears, oh my, get buried last, right? Okay? So that's what we say. We say that the global flood actually buries them in the order of where they lived, not when they lived, but the order of where they lived. And that's actually a much more accurate representation, because the other thing that we find is that there's marine fossils in every single one of those areas, all the way up to the human, to the lions and tigers and bears, the dinosaurs, everything. They all have marine fossils in them. In other words, they were all underwater. Now, there are evolutionists who say, yeah, but we've got uplifts where you have land lifting up, and so you can have some of the marine fossils there. But the amount that we have, the prevalence of it, tells us that it was all underwater. Okay? Now, how can we tell which one of these is correct? Is it when they lived or where they lived? Well, yes, because you have the trilobite. Okay? The trilobite is basically like the roly-poly bug of the ocean. Do you guys have roly-poly bugs?
Yeah.
You touch them and they curl up and then you like plink them. Pew. Okay? You don't do that? I mean, come on, that's good stuff. That's not right. You shouldn't do that. Okay. So they're like the roly-poly bug of the ocean. The question is, how does the trilobite... Here, I've got one right here. They're actually really cute. I know they don't look cute there in the picture, but I've gotten several of them now. And when they get little, they're kind of cute. This is Jojo. I call him Jojo. And so I actually call this one Jojo because I have a bigger one. And when I was doing the Gideon's talk, all the kids were like, "What's his name?" And I was like, "Bob." And they were like, they were mad because I said Bob was dumb and uncomplex. So I promised to feed him ice cream afterwards, okay? So that was Bob. This is Jojo. I have another one named Timmy, okay? Little trilobites are actually the most powerful fossil in the world. And I do a talk called Three Things That Crush Evolution. There's more to it than just this. But this is one of the things that tells us that trilobites are the most powerful fossil in the world because they crush evolution in less than 3 minutes. Okay, here's why. This is what they wrote about trilobites in 1974, the year I was born. Okay, 1974, not that long ago. Okay, it was a really short time ago. All right, they actually wrote this. Now, and here's the key thing. Okay, remember, evolutionists say that this trilobite should be uncomplex, simple, dumb, nothing, right? Creationists say it's actually complex. It's perfectly designed for its environment. It just got buried first. You guys get the distinction? Okay, here's what the scientists said. Trilobites may have been superior to current living animals. They had, in principle, perfect vision. They possessed the most sophisticated eye lenses ever produced by nature. They looked like they were designed by a physicist. Now, does that sound like a simple, uncomplex, dumb animal? Or does that sound like one that's complex, perfectly designed for its environment, and just got buried first? Sounds like it just got buried first, doesn't it? See, the trilobite is the most powerful fossil in the world because it crushes evolution in less than 3 minutes. We can also talk about the Cambrian explosion, which we won't, but the Cambrian explosion, it is in that the Cambrian explosion, and it shows that there is no evolutionary history of all the five major body types. You just cannot win with evolution. It cannot explain the geological column. Okay? So it's not a matter of when they lived, it's a matter of where they lived. The geological column shows us that evolution cannot explain the geological column. Its explanation doesn't hold water for the flood, right? Anyway, that's not the point. They can't all be A material, okay? It can't all be A material, okay? So it's a matter of where they lived. That's what it is. So that's the geological column. Let's take a look at fossils. If we take a look at fossils, we're going to see that fossils have to have the right conditions in order to be created, and only the global flood can give us those right conditions. When we look at fossils, we actually see two different kinds of fossils. We find well-preserved fossils, and then we find fossil graveyards. In other words, animals have been picked up, smashed together, ripped apart, and then just buried in sediment. Okay? So first things first, how do we get this well-preserved fossil? So all of these animals have like hard shells, hard bones, and stuff like that. So we get really good preservation. Well, how do you get that? The only way you can get that is if they're buried fast enough so they can't get away and deep enough so they can't survive. Right? Makes sense. Fast enough so they can't get away, deep enough so they can't survive. So perfect preservation is actually evidence of rapid burial. Because things don't last sitting on the side of the road, right? I mean, I'm from Texas. You know, if it lasts long enough, we'll pick it up and grill it, right? That's not true. We don't do that. That's not true. I've never done that. Mostly because I've never found anything on the side of the road. But I'm just saying I probably wouldn't. But things don't last on the side of the road. They don't last in water either. Okay, they've done experiments with pigs. And they put them in water. No predators get to them, just little fish, little crabs, little bacteria, things like that. They're gone in 7 days. 7 days. Their bones are disarticulated, laying out flat. They've done this over and over again. Things don't last in water. They don't last on the side of the road. If you get perfect preservation like this, it had to have been buried rapidly, fast enough so it can't get away, deep enough so it can't survive. But I tell you what, here's the thing. I'm going to ask somebody to help me plug in my laptop. I forgot to plug it in. Can somebody help me plug in my laptop? I've got the power cord right here. So all these things have perfect preservation, okay? That perfect preservation is evidence of rapid burial. But what about things that are more intricate, maybe soft? Think of it this way. Look at these things. Look at the leaf, the details of the leaf. Look at all those details. It had to have been buried rapidly. It could not have been slow over millions of years. It would have decayed away. All right? If you take a look at this, look at the wings of the insect. The wings of the insect have incredible detail. It had to have been buried rapidly, otherwise it would have been destroyed. It had to have been buried rapidly. Look at this palm tree, this palm leaf. Same thing with it, the detail in it. But it's not just soft things. We actually get action shots. Take a look at this stuff. Here's these guys. Do you think they partied together? This wasn't an oceanic kegger or anything like that. They got picked up, smashed together, and buried in sediment. What about this? I don't know if you guys can tell in the light. I can finish my lunch, okay? I don't know if the light throws it off or not. I can finish my lunch. This guy didn't finish his lunch. He didn't finish eating, okay? That is an action shot that he got rapidly buried. Rapid burial, okay? Deep enough, fast enough so he can't get away, deep enough so he couldn't survive. Here's one that'll hurt some of you, okay? This is an ichthyosaur giving birth. Yeah, imagine that, okay? That would kind of stink. As a matter of fact, there's another one where there's actually three babies, and one of them, because of the way the sediment, because, of course, it gets buried by sediment, and then the next layer gets laid on, over and over and over, and it's crushing everything. There's actually a third baby that's actually being pushed out of the mother's side because they have these big, sharp beaks, and it's being pushed out of the mother from the front. So these things were caught very rapidly, and they were buried very deep with a lot of weight on top of them because they were being crushed. So absolutely, these things that show well-preserved fossils, it's evidence of rapid burial. There's another kind that we get. It's fossil graveyards. These are fossil graveyards we find all over the world. And these are only ones I can find on the internet. Why do I use... So here's a question, because we'll get to this in dinosaurs. Why do I use internet articles? Anybody want to yell out? Give me a reason. Is what? He chickened out all of a sudden. Opposition research, yeah, absolutely. You've got to slog to a lot of evolutionary stuff, but here's the real reason why I do it. I want you guys to know I don't have a secret book. I don't get a secret newsletter. As a matter of fact, most of the stuff I use in my talks are stuff that I started using before I ever got to ICR, okay? I don't have anything, any kind of club or membership. This is stuff you can find on the internet. You've got to slog through. You got to slog through some of the evolutionary stuff, but you can find this stuff on the internet. These are all fossil graveyards found on the internet. In America, there's the Agate Fossil Beds National Monument. They find rhinos, horses, camels, giant wild boars, birds, plants, trees, seashells, and fish. The fish don't hang out with rhinos normally. I don't know if you know that. They aren't best friends, okay? But they're buried together. In other words, the water pick them up, smash them together, and then they're buried. You can see this. You can actually see the layering that it was laid down by water. You can actually see that. And this big pit, why do they put it like that? Because it's all jumbled in here, okay? It's all jumbled. You think about it. Let's see if I have these. I may or may not. So this is an ilium. Everybody say ilium. So it's the hip structure of a Pachycephalosaurus. You guys know, did you ever watch Jurassic Park? And like the more recent ones, I'm not going to call you a sinner. Don't worry if you saw it. Okay? Now I am. No, I'm just kidding. So there's one with like a dome head and it keeps headbutting things. That's a Pachycephalosaurus. This is the hip structure I dug up in Glendive, Montana. I went out there and was digging and found this in seven different pieces. Cracked, crumbled, crushed, you know, all in situ, as they say. So it has all the mud, dirt, dust. So these are two ammonites that are still in matrix here. You got all the dust, dirt, mud, silt, limestone, everything around it, okay? And so you have to clean everything up, glue them together, and then coat it so it all stays together. There's even some putty. There was a piece missing right here, so I puttied it a little bit. But the idea is it's all mixed in. There's also this triceratops rib. This is a triceratops rib, okay? It goes together like that, all cracked, crushed, as you can see, okay? But they're all mixed in together. I found an alligator rib at the same time. Somebody last week found a T-Rex tooth, okay? All mixed together. Hey, this is a great time to advertise my dinosaur dig. So I see... I have four spots left. If you want to dig dinosaurs, if you want to go on an actual dig, we're actually going to Glendive, Montana. And there's a creationist museum called the Glen Dive Dinosaur and Fossil Museum. They're a creationist organization. The field paleontologist, Tommy Lohman, actually takes you out and helps you dig for dinosaur bones. Again, I think it was just a few days ago, they found a T-Rex tooth. That Triceratops bone was there. The ungual claw there. Nope, not the ungual claw, sorry. The Hadrosaur humerus. The Hadrosaur jawbone. All these things are being found there, and you get to keep what you find, okay? So you get to come out. You have Dr. Thomas, who does dinosaurs. You'll see his book out here, Dinosaurs in the Bible. He'll be speaking. We take you out there. You get to dig through. It's kind of hard, you know, because you're digging through. Like, to be fair, I may have stuck a couple of those pieces off to the side thinking they were rock. And they were like, hey, you know that's dinosaur bone. It's like, oh, really? Oh, okay. So I set it aside, and they're like, hey, you know, that one's dinosaur bone too. How about you just go through this pile right over here? Just let me know what's dinosaur bone. But it is a lot of fun. And so we have about four spots left for August 7th through the 11th. If you guys want to check that out, there's brochures on the back. So just real quick. So Agate Fossil Beds National Monument, they find all these things together. That's not the only one. It's all over the world. Go to the Messel Pit in Germany. So famous, they made stamps about it. They find all kinds of things there. Thousands of insects. How do you bury thousands of insects? It has to be rapid. It's got to be fast enough so they can't get away, deep enough so they can't survive. Birds, fish, crocodiles, horses, aardvark, hedgehog, thousands of insects. All these things buried together in a huge fossil graveyard. If you go over to China, the Yijing Formation, okay? Birds, clams, shrimps, pterosaurs, dinosaurs, mammals, insects, all these things buried together in sediment that's laid down by water, picked up, smashed together, ripped apart, and laid down in sediment brought in by water. And last but not least, oh, nope, that was it. All right, so those fossil graveyards, again, they're all over the world. We find them everywhere, in Chile and in Egypt, all kinds of places. These fossil graveyards tell us that there was a massive amount of water that came in and buried things in sediment, okay? So fossils are excellent evidence of the global flood. Let's talk about rock layers. When we look at rock layers, this is an iconic picture, okay? This is the Grand Canyon. A lot of people said, you said you've been to the Grand Canyon, okay? So most of you will know, this is actually really low in the Grand Canyon, because this is a river, and the prevailing story is, this little bitty river over millions of years slowly carved out the Grand Canyon. Now, a lot of people are backing off of that right now because, well, they're coming to their senses. But they're backing off of it. They don't believe in creation, but they're backing off of it. But there's something interesting about this. If you take a look, you can actually see the strata. The strata here, it's kind of hard to see here. It's easier to see over on these TVs, but my laser pointer won't work. So you can see that there's bigger sections of strata. So each strata here. But if you look there, if you look right here, you can see that there's little bitty layers. So this is made up of little bitty layers. Now, evolution tells us that they want to explain this through uniformitarianism. They say this. This is the Berkeley definition. The theory that changes in the Earth's crust during geological history have resulted from the action of continuous and uniform processes. In other words, the simple way of saying that is, the way it's happening today is the way it happened in the past. That's it. Okay? And so they say, hey, each one of these little bitty layers takes thousands of years. And then each one of the bigger layers would take tens to hundreds of thousands of years. And then when you get up to, 2 miles up, it's billions of years. It's hundreds of millions to billions of years, right? Well, here's the problem. Do they know this or do they think this? Somebody yelled out. They think it. Why do they only think and they don't know it? They weren't there, and they've never watched another Grand Canyon be created. If they had watched the second Grand Canyon be created by slow, natural processes, then they could say, hey, it's uniformitarianism. See, the side of science is actually pretty unscientific. The trick is that we found that there's another way that this can happen, and that is through catastrophism. So a lot of you guys know about Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens is technically still an active volcano. It's up in the northwest area, up in the corner here of the United States, right? It's actually erupted multiple times, but the major eruption was in 1980, May 9th, 1980. We've had pictures of it. We've got video. We've got everything, okay? We've watched it happen, and then we watched the recovery of it and watched what happened afterwards. So we've actually seen that this catastrophic event actually created a mini Grand Canyon. It's about 1/20th scale, something like that. But we actually watched the layers be formed, and then we watched the water and mud cut through those hardened layers. We've actually seen this happen, not through slow natural processes, through a catastrophic event. This catastrophic event blew out the side of Mount St. Helens, took all the trees off the side of the mountain over here, and then dumped all the trees into Spirit Lake. Okay, there was a mini Grand Canyon, the Spirit Lake, and then the recovery of the flora. Everybody thought it was going to be centuries before all this, the trees and the grass and beautiful stuff came back. It was almost no time at all that it started to come back. We were completely wrong. Catastrophism is actually an excellent way for us to understand the geological column, the layers that we see, everything. Catastrophism, the definition is, the theory that changes in the Earth's crust during geological history have resulted chiefly from sudden, violent, and unusual events. Can anyone think of a sudden, violent, unusual event that might have occurred? Yes, right back there? The flood, that's right. You should get something for that. Here. Would you like a piece of hadrosaur bone, or would you like a dinosaur, a little dinosaur? You want a piece of bone? All right. So this is an actual piece of hadrosaur bone, which is a plant eater. And Monosaurus is in this family. And he has a duck bill, but he won't eat you because he eats plants. So you're good. So thank you very much for answering. Awesome. Give him a hand. Yeah. So this would be a catastrophic event that could change the face of the earth forever, right? So let's take a look, because what we're saying is that all these layers now were laid down by water. Can I actually show you that? Yes, I can. Take a look at this. This is actually, here the Grand Canyon is. It actually has pinstripe layering. So that cliff I just showed you has pinstripe layering. This has pinstripe layering. If you take a look, this is an unconformity in the Grand Canyon. Evolutionists are confounded because this rock here and this rock here is dated at over 100 millions of years difference. There's a whole bunch of time missing there. They can't figure it out. That's why they call it an unconformity. There's another unconformity that we see. Let's see. Oh, yeah, here it is right here. This is another unconformity. So this is in Colorado, and so it's on the side of a road. You would never know it's there. You wouldn't think of anything of it if you're driving by. But this unconformity has this granite. Everything below this is granite. This is the first sediment layer laid down. This, right here, is a piece of that sediment layer. The trick is that when you're looking at that, if that's the first sediment layer laid down, what is that? That's the first sediment layer laid down by the global flood. And everything below that is creation weak rock. And so this is a sample of that. That first sediment layer, if you want. And everything on this table, you can come over, pick up, touch. You know, don't throw it or anything. But I want you to be able, this is creation. I want you to be able to pick it up and hold on to it. There's even some that we're going to pass around when we get to dinosaurs. That'll be fine. Okay, so you've got this, just this shelf. It's an unconformity, okay? But it's just like pinstripe layering. You can even see here, it's just this pinstripe layering. The face of it may be jagged. But if there's thousands of years of erosion, you should have crazy erosion patterns. It shouldn't be pinstriped. It should have this crazy erosion pattern. But we don't see that. We see this pinstripe layering. So here again, this is the chalk cliffs over in England. You see the same pinstripe layering. You take a look in Ireland. This is in Ireland. Same pinstripe layering. Jagged face, pinstripe layering. You take a look at this. This is over in Asia. Same thing, pinstripe layering. This is in Arkansas. Same thing. It's harder to see, but you can see this pinstripe layering. This is in Egypt. Same pinstripe layering. Same thing is happening. All these things have the same pinstripe layering. And I keep saying that because there's no time for erosion. It is coming in like the waves of that tsunami. Layer after layer after layer. Okay? There's no time for erosion. But can we really see on a massive scale that same kind of pattern? Can we see the same pattern that we see by the ocean, but 500 miles inland on a massive scale, like mountain-type scale, the same pattern? We can. This is actually from six tsunamis. This is down by the beach. It's six tsunamis. It was in stairs, and the stairs got covered, and then they cut them out because it was about to be time for people to come to the beach, right? And so six tsunamis. Look at the patterns, the light and the dark, and light and dark. You've seen that before. That's the same pattern that you see in the Grand Canyon. The light and the dark, the light and the dark. Same pattern, 500 miles inland, nowhere near the ocean, and on the massive scale, you've seen the same pattern. Take a look at this. See how water has actually come through and shaped the sand. But hundreds of miles inland in the painted desert, nowhere near water, you have the exact same patterns. And you can actually see the layers that have been laid down. Massive scale, same pattern, okay? What about this? This is sand. A lot of people say that sand, like granular sand, doesn't layer like that. It actually does. It layers just like that. And then you see the erosion pattern here. You've seen this exact same thing. 500 miles inland in the Grand Canyon, same layering and same erosion. See the erosion? Same pattern. But it's on a massive scale, hundreds of miles inland, nowhere near the ocean. When we look at that, we can see it. If you fly over the Colorado Mountains, and probably these, the California Mountains too, if you look down on them, let's see if I can go backwards. This is going to mess me up probably. As you fly over the mountains, you see this. That's the pattern that you see from the top. You actually see that pattern and you go, oh, wait a second. I remember the first time I flew over the Colorado Mountains and I started getting excited. I was like, wait a second, that's that. I've seen that before. But on a massive scale, hundreds of miles away from the ocean, and yet everybody says, nah, there's no way there was a global flood, right? I'll tell you what, let's go to polystrate fossils real quick. This one's an easy one. We're talking about the biggest one would be the trees. Trees are polystrate fossils, okay? And I know I'm running over here. I'm going to try and go fast. Polystrate fossils go through multiple layers of strata. So in other words, strata is a multiple of stratum, one layer. So it's going through multiple layers, right? Well, if it takes thousands of years to get one layer, and hundreds of thousands of years to get, say, 20, does a tree last that long? No, it doesn't. The tree would be decayed and gone by that time, before you got through two or three layers. The only way that you can get polystrate fossils is if those strata, or the layers, are laid down quickly, one right after the other. Here's a real quick one, crossbedding. When we talk about crossbedding, it's this slanted area right here. So when wind or water actually pushes sediment, it pushes it, and it usually winds up going up a little hill, and then it'll fall off like this. Okay? Well, that actually creates an angle. If it's over 30 degrees, it's wind. If it's under 30 degrees, it's water. We know this from experimentation. We know that this is true. Remember I told you the Coconino sandstones, remember? Well, when we go to the Grand Canyon, not only do we hike and see beautiful scenery, Dr. Thomas takes people to the Coconino sandstones and shows them areas of crossbedding. And you can actually look at the angle and see that one's at 20 degrees. It's less, which means that it's water. The Coconino sandstones were laid down by water, which means that every single layer of the Grand Canyon was laid down by water. And then I had to fight to the death with a scorpion, okay? He jumped out of nowhere. Luckily, with my cat-like skills, I survived. But it was hurtful that you laughed quite like that. It was a little hurtful. I'm not going to lie to you, but it's probably true. But real quick, curved layering, curved strata. If we take a look at curved strata, how do you get curved strata? Here's bent. This is actually almost completely bent. You have this big, huge curves. So I went over to Scotland into, they call it Sicker Point. And it was there was a guy there named Hutton. And he said that this was an icon of evolution because there was actual multiple kinds of rock being laid down, one this way, one this way. And he said, oh, it must have happened over millions of years. So my question to people, when I was over in Scotland, I was teaching over there, and I said, who can bend rock? Little kid raised his hand. I was like, okay, come on up. I'll let him try. And another guy, big bodybuilder guy, was like, I can do it. I'm like, okay, sure, why not? And so he goes, and he snaps the rock in half. And this is the rock that he snapped in half. And I keep it because you should have seen the pastor and the pastor's wife's face. They're like, oh. They thought that he had just ruined my entire, display. The point was, he cannot bend the rock. He can only break the rock. How do you bend rock? Well, it has to be soft. Those layers have to be soft. Well, how do you get those layers soft? They have to be laid down by water, and they had to have not been hardened yet. That's how you curve the strata. That's how you bend the strata. Now, is there another way? Yes. If the rock is superheated, it can also bend. But that's why we go and do experiments and test the rock, and we can tell whether the rock has been superheated, and none of those have been superheated. So we know that it had to have been wet when it was actually bent and curved. Real quick, that's rock layers. Let's talk about consistent sediment. This is Dr. Clary. You'll see his book right out there called Carved in Stone. There's a DVD set and a book, and it's all about one of the most exciting things in the global flood, sedimentation analysis. I know that sounds boring. It really does. Sedimentation analysis. That's not what you want to tell your girlfriend. What do? I do sedimentation analysis. That's not cool. But it is actually one of the most exciting things for the global flood, because this is one of the slides that I used to do. I did this slide right here. Because we would see the Tapete sandstone in America, and then over in Canada, we would see Tapete sandstone. And we're like, I think that's the same stuff. And I'm pretty sure it's in the same level. I don't know. And so we would create slides like this and say, hey, we believe that all this sedimentation is running all along the continents, and that you're going to see this as a global effect. Okay? And of course, if you have a global effect, you have to have a global cause, right? And so the problem is that we can't see underneath our feet. It's not like a glass-bottom boat or anything like that. You can't see down in there until Dr. Clary came along. Dr. Clary was an oil guy. He was one of the guys that was there who's a geologist and a hydrogeologist. He would go, you guys should dig right over there, and I think you'll find oil. So they'd go over there and dig for oil, right? Well, what happens when they dig for oil is they drill down, and they pull up a huge core of the rock that's in there. And then they notate all the sedimentation, everything about it, and then stick it in a rack and store it, right? Because they don't really care that much. They might go back and look at it later, but they don't really care about it. Dr. Clary was like, wait a second. If I could get access to those cores, I could tell what sedimentation was in there, what order it was in, and I could do it on all the continents. Now, I remember him telling me, we were driving, in one of the first events I ever did, I remember him telling me, he goes, I remember thinking, if I'm wrong, I'm about to destroy the flood. I'm about to do something really bad for creation. But he didn't. What he's actually found is that on all the continents, he's done six. That book has three in there. He's done six. It's all the same sediment in the same pattern on all the continents. It's a global effect that has to have a global cause. It's so accurate that he can actually map out the sedimentation through the six mega sequences: the Sauk, Tippecanoe, Kaskaskia, Absaroka, Zuni, and Tejas. The Tejas is actually really the runoff. It's after the 150 days. This is where the water's running off. The Zuni is right there where the water peaks and starts to run off. The Tippecanoe is where the ark is actually starting to float, if I remember correctly. He's actually created a map. Days 1 through 40, this is what the sedimentation would have looked like for 1 through 40. If you go 40 through 150, this is where it's covered, the high mountains. Take a look at this part right here. You're like, well, there's no sedimentation there, Dave. That's a terrible idea. Okay, well, think about it. It's the bathtub ring. Okay? You ever been dirty, you get in a bathtub, and then you drain the water, and there's a ring around the bathtub? That's what that is. It covers the high mountains, but the sedimentation didn't cover the mountains. The water covered it, and as it ran off the land and the sedimentation settled, it creates that bathtub ring there, 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 all these places. That's days 40 through 150. It actually lines up with the biblical account of Genesis, where the flood begins in the Sauk, the ark flows in the Absaroka, the flood peaks in the Zuni, and the Tejas is where it runs off. There is actually really good evidence for the global flood in the ground. No doubt. And a lot of the stuff, like Clary's book, he sends out to evolutionists. He's done this. He sends out to evolutionists. They go, wow, I don't like your book. And he's like, well, is there something wrong with it? They go, no, there's nothing wrong with the data. I just don't like it. Okay? They can't discredit the actual processes, the things that he's finding, because it's evolutionary oil people that are pulling these up. He's just showing you the data, and it's showing you that the global flood is real, that it's a global effect, and it has to have a global cause, and that's the global flood. Real quick as we wrap up, I told you I was going to go long, and I apologize. The flood in geological time, because that's the thing. You go, well, Dave, don't they date these rocks? Do they date the rocks? Yeah, they date the rocks. But they use three flawed assumptions in radioisotope dating. Radioisotope dating says you have a parent element and a daughter element. This is a radioactive isotope. It decays into an element that is not radioactive. So you can have multiple lead. So you can do lead-lead, you can do potassium argon, rubidium, strontium, all these things, okay? So the decay rate from the parent to the daughter has a certain time frame. For C14, it's 5,700 years. For most of them, it's millions of years. Millions of years, okay? But in order to do this dating, they have to make three assumptions that they cannot prove. But because they can get the answer that they want, they like it, okay? Here's the problem. We know that radioisotope dating doesn't work. Number one, all radioisotopes, depending on, no matter what the decay rate is, if it's in the same sample, it should give the same answer. Does it give the same answer? Mm-mm. It's not just wrong. It's wildly and embarrassingly wrong. If you turn in a sample, they ask you, how old do you think this is? I'm sorry, you're supposed to tell me that, okay? Why are they asking? Because they get wildly different answers depending on what radioisotope they use. Now, it has to be in the sample for them to be able to use it, but they can get 200,000 years old, 750,000 years old, 1.8 billion years old. And then they're stuck trying to figure out which one is right. Which one's right, sorry. Okay? And they look at your little piece of paper and you say, well, I think it's around 700,000 years old. Hey, what do you know? We got 750,000. That's how old it is, okay? We've actually had people call labs up and call them out on this, and they go, yeah, that's what happens. They don't care because they believe that they have the dates right, okay? But the problem is anytime that we test the test, not only the tests against one another, they get wrong answers, so we know radioisotope dating doesn't work. We also test it against rocks that we know the age of. We get it wrong, not just wildly and embarrassingly wrong, like Dave on the dance floor wrong, okay? You know what I mean? Again, hurtful but true, okay? I heard it right over in that area, right over there, hurtful but true. But Dave on the dance floor wrong, and you should be able to yell out Dave on the dance floor wrong when I show you these, okay? I want you to do it. So we tested the Grand Canyon with rubidium strontium dating. We actually had a project called the RATE group, the RATE project, where we did this with coal, diamonds, all kinds of stuff. We wanted to test radioisotope dating. We did the Grand Canyon. We went to the very bottom, to the Cardenas basalt, and we tested that. Then we went all the way to the top. The youngest one should be hundreds of millions of years younger. We tested both. The bottom, 1.111 billion years. The top, 1.143 billion years. The youngest dated older than the oldest. Does radioisotope dating work? That's not just wrong, that's what? Yeah. That still stings. Okay. If you go to Mount St. Helens, in Mount St. Helens, it erupted a few times between 1980 and 1986. In 1996, we tested it. We knew the date of the rock was 10 years old. Everybody say 10 years old. 10 years old. Here we go. What did they get? 340,000 to 2.8 million years old. That's not just wrong, that is. Yes, exactly. So the idea is this. Now, what they said with Mount St. Helens is, oh, well, there was excess argon that was actually input into it, into the samples. Or there was excess argon in the actual rock itself. So when we took samples, there was too much argon in it. It hadn't actually decayed from the potassium. It was just extra in there. Okay, yeah, that's great. Then how do you know that's not what's happening in all the other times, right? That's a great question, isn't it? If you get it wrong every time you know the date, but every time you don't know the date, you're like, yeah, right on, we got it, nailed it. You know, that's a real problem. Radioisotope dating just does not work. The truth is that the Bible tells us a very different story of the global flood, a very different history of the earth than what evolution does. The tablets that we see, the Gilgamesh, all these show us that the flood happened. 300 accounts shows us that the flood happened. The details are not as important, but it shows that they happened. When we look in the ground, we find evidence after evidence after evidence that evolution cannot explain. They cannot explain the geological column. They cannot explain the rock layers. It is only the flood that is a good explanation for those. And then when they try to radioisotope the rocks, we know that it's wrong. That's why we can in confidence say the evidence points to a catastrophic flood, and that means that the Bible can be trusted. I don't know if you guys know this. My entire point in doing this is that you would trust God's word more and that you would live boldly for Jesus. That's why I do it. And it's not so that you can win an argument. It's so that you can win a soul. You know, and you know the difference. Let's pray. Father, I just thank you so much that they have bared with me while I went long. Lord, we pray that this evidence would not go wasted, that it would resonate in our hearts, that we would remember just the right things, not everything, but just the right things to give somebody a word. Give somebody a word that they would know that you've spoken to them, Lord. Would you give us those divine appointments so that we could use this information from today and win souls for you, to break down those strongholds, to draw them to you in your loving kindness. So in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, I went long on this one, so it's 11:35. So I guess we'll do a 10-minute break and then we'll just hurry. Is that okay? All right, 10-minute break. Y'all make it an 8-minute break and then come back quick, okay?